All right. Well, you remember in Daniel 4, we had the interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's second dream. That dream had to do with him being deposed because of his pride. And I don't think I got to actually show you these slides, but I thought it would be worth our thinking about them. So the dream is interpreted, and Nebuchadnezzar is told, okay, you're going to be run out from among men, and you're going to have to spend seven times out with the beasts of the field and so forth. Well, it was a year later that Nebuchadnezzar is walking through his palace, and he is boasting about the great things that he has done. I think this is interesting because of the historical value for us also. He's glorying in his own greatness. I have a book called The Excavations of Babylon. And you can see the book is 100 years old now, but this gentleman here, Mr. Coldaway, had gone in, and he was a key figure in excavating the city of Babylon. Now, among other things, what you see here, and of course it just looks like a bunch of ruins, but you can see that it was an architectural site. Somebody had built something of significance here. This is the famous Ishtar Gate. To look at it this way, maybe you can't see why Nebuchadnezzar was boasting about how great a buildings he had put together. But this is an artist rendering of what this would have looked like. This would be the Ishtar Gate, one of the entrances into this magnificent city. And this was the processional. And so you can see from the ruins that this processional area was here, where when there was a great ceremony of some kind, maybe Babylon had conquered some other group of people, maybe they would have brought the captives from Israel through here as they paraded them in triumph over this group of people. This would have been something like, and we know it was colored. You can still see some of the residue from the coloring and so forth. This is an artist depiction. It doesn't exist anymore, but there are ancient descriptions of this. This is one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, the Hanging Gardens. Supposedly, Nebuchadnezzar constructed this, I think it was for his wife. But again, we have artists describing all of this, how the foliage flowed over the walls and how tall it was and so forth, and the waters and so forth. So these are the kinds of things that Nebuchadnezzar constructed in his day, and this is what he's thinking about as he's walking through his palace, how great things he has put together. So as he's thinking about all of this, then the voice comes and pronounces to him that the kingdom has departed from him. He's to be driven from men and so forth, and he's going to live like beast for these seven times. And so here we have, I know that's grainy, but this is sort of an artist depiction of him out there in the wilderness living like a wild man, eating the grass of the field and so forth. He had gone mad, lost his mind. This is another, and you know, you can see here he's depicting the nails like eagle's claws and so forth, and he just really looks like a wild man. But as it was stated, when he repented, when he came to himself after the fulfillment of these seven times, God restored him. He recognized God's dominion. You know, what's the theme of the whole book? God rules the nations. God rules the nations. And in that last verse of that chapter, Nebuchadnezzar says, "Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, will praise and extol and honor the God of heaven, the King of heaven, because for all his ways are truth. All his works are truth. All his ways, justice. And those that walk in pride, he is able to abase." See, he learned that lesson the hard way. He learned that lesson the hard way, but he did learn it. Now, I think that's useful, because as we begin to go into this next chapter, we're going to see a man who maybe should have learned that lesson from Nebuchadnezzar, but declined to do so. Chapter 5, the famous handwriting on the wall. Before we dive too deeply into it, let me give you this overview, and then I want to talk with you about the king that we meet in this chapter. This chapter can be broken up this way. At least this kind of division is helpful for me. First, we see the vessels. And of course, these vessels are the holy vessels that were taken from the temple at Jerusalem being defiled. We have a disturbance for the king that is brought on by the handwriting on the wall. The prophet, our man Daniel, is drafted to come in and again give the interpretation. This was the gift that he had received from God. He does give the interpretation, that is, the writing is decoded, and then the kingdom is divided or taken away. The king that we meet in this chapter, first thing we have to know is our king here appears several years after Nebuchadnezzar, maybe several decades. After Nebuchadnezzar. So there is a significant gap in time between chapter 4 and chapter 5. When we see chapter 5 open, we're told from the very first word in the chapter, our king is Belshazzar. It is interesting to note that critics of the Bible for a long time, a very long time, claim that there was no king by this name in the Babylonian Chaldean Empire at the end of it. They said this man is a work of fiction, and so the Bible is not true, and the book of Daniel itself, of course, is a work of fiction. Of course, time goes on. The Bible is vindicated. We have found, archaeologists have found, this inscription, the cylinder inscription of Nabonidus. Now, Nabonidus is Belshazzar's father, and they find, and he was a king. He was a king there for sure, and we find this cylinder where Belshazzar is described as the son of the king. Nabonidus, his scroll or his inscription, and he refers to Belshazzar as the son of the king. So this was a real person, we know that. And by the way, there are several cuneiform writings that talk about this man that have been subsequently uncovered. A very real person. We have as much archaeological evidence for him as we have for some people that we accept as being real people without giving a second thought. Very real person. It is also interesting to note that from these writings we know that Belshazzar reigned contemporaneously with his father for a period of time. Now that is interesting for us because some people have said that the references to him as king are historically inaccurate. Now I just told you that Nabonidus's cylinder referred to him as the son of the king. And so some people say, well, he was not the king, he was the son of the king. Well, some of these other writings tell us that they ruled together for a period of time. Nabonidus was king. Belshazzar was governor over the province of Babylon, which would have been the chief province. He was second in command, if you will. But for a period of time, these two men reigned and ruled together. So it is not inaccurate at all to refer to him as king. He was co-king, if you will, with his father for a period of time. Also, it is interesting as we dive into this, you're going to see in the chapter, but you guys have seen it because you read it twice already, you're going to see in the chapter that Nebuchadnezzar is referred to as his father several times. Well, I just told you, the man's father's name was Nabonidus. And when you look at the reign of these various kings in the empire, there are a handful between Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. And I believe Nebuchadnezzar's son, whatever his Babylonian name was, in the scriptures he's referred to as Evil-Merodach. Okay, so how do we reconcile this? It really isn't that hard. As I looked and tried to trace the lineage from Nebuchadnezzar to Belshazzar, I find that Nebuchadnezzar's son reigned directly after him. His son-in-law reigned after his son, and then a couple generations down from his son-in-law, we find Belshazzar. And so this man Belshazzar would have been a distant relative of Nebuchadnezzar. And maybe that's enough, because we certainly find in Scripture instances of people being descendants referring to people several generations back as father. We certainly find that, and you can find that, you can see one example of that in 2 Chronicles 17 and 3, where Jehoshaphat is said to be, that David is said to be Jehoshaphat's father, and obviously he is not his direct father, he's a descendant. But at the same time, there are instances where people who were simply further down the line in the royal procession are referred to as fathers, not biologically fathers, but progenitors, if you will, in terms of the royal throne. So either one of those would make this a very consistent usage of the term father. The likelihood, as best I can tell, is that both are true. This man Belshazzar served as king with his father, was likely a distant relative of Nebuchadnezzar, but even if he wasn't related by blood in any way, he stood in the royal line in terms of being on that throne, and you see things like that even with the kings in Israel, not directly related to the kings who came before, but still called the son of, in the spirit of sometimes. Okay, any questions about that? Does that all make sense? I thought we should do that so before we dive into the text, so I don't have to break away from looking at the text to sort of lay that groundwork again. All right, no questions? Thought didn't lose you or anything? All right, good. All right, then let's take a look at the text. In these first four verses, we see a discussion of the vessels being defiled. The Bible says, beginning at verse number 1, Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink therefrom. In chapter 1, verse 2, we find that when Nebuchadnezzar went in and conquered this area, he took these sacred vessels from the temple in Jerusalem, carried them back to Babylon, and put them in the house of his gods. And that's where they were. So here Belshazzar is engaging in what seems to be some type of celebratory feast. And he says, you know what? While the liquor is flowing like this, let's go get those sacred vessels. You remember that God over there in Israel? Let's go get that stuff we took out of his temple and let's swill our liquor out of that. Me and all my wives and my concubines and all these lords. He's sort of showing off here, and he wants to use these things as common vessels. And so in verse 3, then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem, and the king and his lords and his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. Well, this is what launches us into the rest of what happens after this. We have an irreverent, disrespectful, obviously, a profane scene here. My research kind of tells me that it was not uncommon for these Eastern kings to have these large banquets and so forth. And sometimes you can even read this, the kings in Israel, they would sometimes have, you know, thousands of people eating at their table, if you will. They would be responsible for providing for lots and lots of people. And this seems to be what he's doing. But it seems on this occasion that he is having a feast for some reason in particular, celebration of some kind, a special occasion. And that's the context in which he decides that it's a good idea for him to drink from these holy vessels, golden vessels. But I want you to think about this. As this all plays out, how God interprets this should help us to see what he's intending to do. He's not just wanting to drink from these because they're nice. In his mind, this is a symbol of triumph. We have conquered this people. Our gods are greater than their gods. Fetch me these sacred vessels that they have consecrated to their God, and we're going to use these as common drinking vessels as we celebrate our gods. This is supposed to be some display of triumph of his pagan gods over the God of heaven. Right? That display is what launches us into this famous episode. The king is disturbed. Verses 5 through 9. In the same hour, at the time while they are doing all of this, the alcohol is flowing, they are in such a celebratory mood, came forth the fingers or appendages of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance was changed in him, and his thoughts troubled him, and the joints of his loins were loosened, and his knees smote one against another. The king cried aloud to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, the soothsayers. The king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, "Whosoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold about his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then came in all the king's wise men, but they could not read the writing nor make known to the king the interpretation. Then was King Belshazzar greatly troubled, and his countenance was changed in him, and his lords were perplexed. So, as he is doing all this celebrating, and of course this would trouble you too, right? A part of a man's hand appears, and it doesn't say whether he was using an instrument, so I can't say either, but either with his finger or with some instrument, he begins to write on the wall. And the hand is writing in a well-lit area. Of course, you know, they didn't have electricity like we have here, so they had the lighting along the walls and so forth, and so the writing is taking place in a well-lit area, and the king sees all of this. Now, apparently, he is troubled in part because he doesn't understand what the writing says. Now, that obviously is significant to him. I don't know. I would be concerned that the hand is there in the first place. It would trouble me that there's a hand out of nowhere writing on the wall, but I'm sure that didn't help any. But he's concerned about what the meaning of all of this might be. And so this puts a damper on the celebration. It kind of changes the king's mood a bit. And I don't know if you guys can see this. In my own mind, I like to put these pictures in the background that talk about whatever. You can't see it, but it's nice to me anyway. This is sort of supposed to be a depiction of kind of what's going on here. We've got a hand, and it's writing these words on the wall, and everybody's attention is now focused on that. So the king does what these kings always seem to do. He does the same thing that Nebuchadnezzar had done. I've got a question. I don't have an answer. I've got these wise men. I'm supporting these guys. Let them be some help to me. All the wise men, all the enchanters, all the Chaldeans, you guys need to come, and you need to help me understand what is happening here. What is this writing? So notice that he not only wants the interpretation of the writing, but he needs help reading the writing. What does it say? And in what has become a familiar pattern to us as we read the book, the wise men in Babylon are worth about a plug nickel put together, right? They cannot tell him what he needs to know. This is the context in which our man Daniel appears again. Now you notice the pattern. It just continues to happen, that these men who are imbued with earthly wisdom, or, you know, to the extent that they're engaging in necromancy and that kind of stuff, you know, they're sorcerers and they're going through all the magical stuff like those guys back in Egypt that Moses had to contend with. To the extent that they had whatever insight they had, it paled in comparison to what God had given Daniel. They continually fall short. And this is the context in which the need for our prophet arises. If you look at verse 10, you see Daniel, how it is that he enters into a circumstance here. In verse 10, now the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet house. The queen spoke and said, O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance be changed. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And the king Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, I say, your father, made him master of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. For as much as an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding, interpretation of dreams and showing of dark sentences and dissolving of doubts were found in the same Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. I'm going to pause right there. Now, isn't it significant? Isn't it significant? I told you, obviously some period of time, several decades it seems, from what I can tell from that lineage of kings there in Babylon, it would have been a couple of decades at least since Nebuchadnezzar had died. And Daniel's still around. Now, he's not the young boy that we meet in Daniel 1 anymore. He has served Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar's been gone a long time, but isn't it significant that his reputation is still there? The queen goes all the way back and says, there was this guy Daniel. In the days of your father, in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, this man had an excellent spirit. This man could answer questions that no one else could answer. This man had, and remember now, this is a polytheistic society. This man had the spirit of the gods in him. He has some supernatural influence, some supernatural abilities that will enable him to do what all of your wise men have been unable to do. And so she recommends that Daniel be called based on his prior service under Nebuchadnezzar, but also based on his prior status. Do you see it again? She says he was the master of the wise men that Nebuchadnezzar had. A lot of parallels, aren't there, between Daniel and Joseph there in Egypt, how a man could be basically taken in bondage and could rise to this kind of height. You know, Joseph first, before he became basically prime minister in Egypt, he was over a man's house, he's over the prison. I mean, wherever he was, he rose to positions of height and prominence because of God's blessings on him. And so based on her recommendation, the king does call, and he calls Daniel, and he commends him. Look at verse 13. Then was Daniel brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, are you that Daniel who are of the children of the captivity of Judah, whom the king my father brought out of Judah? Now, this is your memory verse, right? Verse 14. I have heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. I picked that verse because I think it is pivotal to his introduction into all of this, right? Why is he being called? Because of his reputation. Now, why is he being given this opportunity to serve? Because of his reputation. And I think sometimes we should think about, you know, our reputation. I think sometimes maybe we focus on our reputation because of our own pride. I mean, I'm just being honest, right? We want people to think good things about us. And I don't think we're unaware that our reputation is important to God because we represent Him. But do we oftentimes think about the fact that our reputation will bring us into positions to serve? It just matters how we present ourselves, how we conduct ourselves. And this man says, I have heard of you. Now, what has he heard? That the spirit of the gods, his polytheistic mind, are in you. Well, I don't know whatever people hear about me. It would be really nice if what they hear is, you know, the spirit of God is in that guy. And, of course, he has conducted himself in a way that is indicative of light. And God has given him understanding. God has given him excellent wisdom. I think that's a good example for us to think about the significance of our reputation. That's why he was in this position to serve and ultimately to do God's work. The king tells him that he would like his help because his other wise men had fallen short. In verse 15, now the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me, and that they should read this writing and make known to me the interpretation thereof, but they could not show the interpretation of the thing. But I have heard of you that you can give interpretations and dissolve doubts. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me the interpretation thereof, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold about your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. You know, what's the significance of that? This idea of purple, you know, now purple doesn't mean anything, right? Purple, whatever your, what's your favorite color, purple, green, we think all this stuff is the same. But when you go back to Bible times, they could not manufacture purple the way we do. They had to get purple from, I forget exactly, they got it from a, if it was a flower or an insect or something, from a shell. Yeah, the boy knows. They got it from a shell, and it was hard to get. So Lydia was a seller of purple. It was hard to harvest this dye, so it was expensive, and only rich people could afford it. So when he says that he's going to clothe him in purple, I'll make you rich, and I'll promote you. It's important that he says to the third, as the third ruler in the kingdom. Now, I told you why historically, because his father was first. And he was second. So he's saying, I will give you as much as I'm in a position to give you. He would be third. I think that is also, that's one of those things that I told you that only a person who was alive at that time, right, could have understood some of these nuances, which confirms the historicity of the book. This is the kind of thing. Remember, for a long time, people just never even believed this guy existed. And here it is true, not only that he existed, but that he was only in a position to offer this man the third position in the kingdom. Daniel's not interested in his rewards. He makes that plain to us beginning in verse 17. And here he gives us what I'm calling the decoding of this writing. Now let's go ahead and take a look at this. This is the bulk of the information that we find in the chapter. Then Daniel answered and said to the king, let your gifts be to yourself. I don't want it. Give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing unto the king and make known to him the interpretation. Anybody have an idea why he was willing to read this? Why he was willing to give the interpretation? Since he didn't want the reward, why was he interested in doing it? The man didn't even seem to know who Daniel was. Why was Daniel willing to help him? Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah, where did Daniel get the understanding? Where did he get the, how could he read it and know what it meant? Because this information was given to him by God, and he was doing what God wanted done, which was to reveal to this man the message that had been pinned on the wall. O you king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the kingdom and greatness and glory and majesty. Why did Nebuchadnezzar ascend to the heights that he did? Daniel says God gave it to him. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all the peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he slew, and whom he would, he kept alive, and whom he would, he raised up, and whom he would, he put down. But then his heart was lifted up, and his spirit was hardened, so that he dealt proudly. He was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. And he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild asses. He fed with grass like oxen, and his body was wet and with the dew of heaven. Listen to it. Until he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men, and that he sets up over it whoever he will. There it is again, the sovereignty of God. It just keeps being repeated. Nebuchadnezzar had to learn this lesson the hard way, he says. He reminds him of that. And then, look, he rebukes him. He chides him here. Beginning at verse 22, "And you, his son, O Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all of this. But you lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords and your wives and your concubines have drank wine from them and have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone." Listen to this. "Which see not, nor hear, nor know, and the God in whose hand your breath is, and whose are all your ways, you have not glorified." Boy, that is a very strong rebuke. He reminds him of something that, listen, what happened to Nebuchadnezzar was the kind of thing that it should have taught a lesson to everybody who ruled in Babylon after him. Now, this is the greatest of the kings you've ever had. And look what God did to this man to teach him humility. And he says to Belshazzar, "And you knew this. You know very well what happened to this man. And yet you're going to fall prey to your own pride just as he did." Well, this makes it clear that that act of drinking from those vessels was a rebellion. It was a declaring of war, so to speak, against God. The rebuke here makes all of that very clear. You're going to use these holy items in just about the most profane way that they can be used. So, in verse 24, we're told explicitly that the writing was a reply to the king's conduct in this respect. "Then was the part of the hand sent from before him, and this writing was inscribed." Now here's the writing in verse 25. "This is the writing that was inscribed, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin." Now that may or may not be right. That's the best I can do. "This is the interpretation of the thing, Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you are weighed in the balances and found wanting. God has judged you. Perez, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians." Then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold around his neck and made proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. So he's promoted anyway. Daniel had said he wasn't interested. Anybody have a good guess why he wasn't that interested in being third ruler in a kingdom that was going to be destroyed that night? Anybody want to take a wild guess why that didn't excite him? He told them to keep it. But Belshazzar said, "Well, no, listen, we're going to go ahead and make you a rich man and promote you. You'll be the number three ruler in this kingdom." The end of the chapter, we see that Daniel wasn't number three ruler in that kingdom for a whole long time. In verse 30, that should say verse 30 to 30, 31. There aren't 32 verses. That's my mistake there. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, and there's good reason to think that, right? Because you remember what Nebuchadnezzar does in chapter 4 is he makes the proclamation. Chapter 4 is him announcing what he has learned. And he has done that because he wants people to know, because he wants people to learn from his mistake. And, you know, we would get the idea that if someone before Belshazzar had been this haughty and proud, had tried to flaunt themselves before God in this way, maybe God would have responded in this way to them, which makes it seem that this would have been a... Yeah. You know what? Some lessons, we learn them the hard way, and enough time goes by, and we don't remember them anymore. But that's a good observation to make. Well, in verse 30, in that night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. I've read some things that suggested that Darius had captured him. Hard to say if he or his father had died first, but he was slain in the siege or the takeover. And Darius the Mede, who was, you know, the Medes and the Persians were together, like the Babylonians and the Chaldeans. Darius the Mede received the kingdom, overthrew the Babylonians, and he was about 62 years old. There is the gap in time between these two chapters, and you're going to see, so we will go from Nebuchadnezzar, and we'll start talking about Belshazzar, and here we just run into Darius, and now we're going to talk about Darius, and then we will go back and start talking about Belshazzar again. So you're going to see that the chapters themselves are not in a chronological order, but certainly I think that these chapters fit very nicely together because of the relationship between what Nebuchadnezzar did and what happened to him, the lesson he was supposed to learn. Right on the heels of that, we see one of his descendants, whether biologically or just on the throne, failed to learn the very lesson that God had taught to Nebuchadnezzar and falls because of the same foible, the same weakness in his character, that is pride. And then in this chapter, we see that God uses or allows Darius to take over the kingdom. And going into the next chapter, we see Daniel during the time of the reign of Darius. Interesting thing to think about. Daniel ascended to great heights under Nebuchadnezzar. Some time goes on. We don't have all the details about these rulers between Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. But here again, though it's at the very end, we see him ascend to great heights again, number 3 in the kingdom. And then the kingdom falls, and as we go into chapter 6, guess where we find our man Daniel? New ruler, new power. Guess where we find our man Daniel? Ascending to great heights again. Next week, if you don't mind, let's read Daniel chapter 6. Let's read it a couple times. It's not a very long chapter. I would suggest to you that verse 10 would be a good memory verse. I know that you're very familiar with the episode here, but I want you to think carefully about why Daniel wound up in the lion's den in the first place. We know he went to the lion's den. Question is why? And I want to invite you to think about that question from several perspectives, right? His adversaries, why did he go to the lion's den? The king, why did he go? His own perspective, God's perspective. I think there's a lot of different ways to look at this, and there's some help in thinking about it from these various perspectives. Thank you.